Hi, this is Roger Green, host of the Surfing the Mesh Tsunami podcast. This week, we are offering five conversations from episode 12, with Sven Franke and Will Alazawi joining Joran, Louise, and me to consider what failures have taught us about drug development, particularly if the success of the Resdiffra launch. Plus, from the vault, a conversation from last September about differences between how we would use NITs to evaluate patients for trials versus evaluate the efficacy of drugs in an individual patient. Louise Campbell starts this final conversation by asking whether we are paying sufficient attention to old drugs that might have value in MASH. She points to a recent study demonstrating that low-dose aspirin significantly affects liver fat, which suggests that possibly we're not thinking broadly enough about the use of older agents in MASH. To hear more about this study, listen to last week's episode, Season 5, Episode 11. Joran Schottenberg comments that without robust NITs, it will be difficult to prove these effects, particularly, as I add, for a drug that will not produce sufficient revenue for biopharma to conduct and pay for the larger trials. After a brief digression over whether we know how to shorten the time to drug approvals, short answer, not until we have better approaches to using NITs, I ask my closing question, how will having a drug approved affect the conduct of trials going forward? Answers vary and present a complex picture. You'll have to listen to learn. Having an approved drug changes lots of things for the better, but not everything. This conversation considers some of the issues we've yet to resolve. So just sit back, listen, enjoy, learn. When you're done, join the dialogue in our LinkedIn discussion group. Who else has questions or comments on this general topic of what we've learned about trials and what effect that will have on drugs going forward?
Louise Campbell.
Because we've not really been doing a very good job of assessing underlying health in all the medications that are out there and have been approved for all sorts of diseases, we might be blindsided with something that's out there that once we start assessing patients more for liver health and non-invasively, because we can do that now, we might discover it. AKA, you've got that recent study with aspirin. Aspirin has been around for an awful long time. It's obviously potentially been reducing liver fat in people for an awful long time, maybe not to the levels that we needed. I think it was the Harvard study that showed that. So we might actually find that we've got drugs out there that are doing relatively good jobs within fatty liver that we've just never assessed because we've not been looking beyond a blood test realistically. We've not been doing the level of non-invasive therapies and techniques that we've now got access to. How many studies have really used MRI PDFF to do anything other than our studies here in fatty liver? Because that's what we've been looking at. So if we can expand that into other medications, we may find that there are already combinations out there that could be working, not dissimilar to the ones the guys have described. So I think we could be blindsided somewhere along the line. And as we learn more and investigate more and assess people's livers better going forward, potentially, we may well be able to find more of those medications that are already partially working in some. So I'd like to think there's something out there that is helping that we'll discover because we get better at discovering it.
Joran Schottenberg.
I agree with Louise that we got to be open-minded and even look for some unexpected combinations. I mean, the challenge is, again, we don't have that NIT that will get us definite approval. And the change in MRI PDFF in that study with aspirin, which is great, you know, it will need to be shown to prove that on a bigger scale and with more patients and different outcomes. So there's always the caveat of that these trials are so complex these days, it makes it challenging, in particular if you have a drug that's giving to a lot of the patients a priori for their cardiovascular risk.
Well, there are also the economics, which is who will spend money to do a low-dose aspirin trial? Governments aren't funding that scale of study anymore, and no manufacturer is going to make any money on it.
The challenge. It means we shouldn't give up.
We shouldn't give up. I mean, I think it's a fascinating result. That's a case, by the way, where somebody could put low-dose aspirin on top of the therapy, claim that there's a logic for having them as combination, put them in a single pill and see what you could do with it. Back at odd combinations. Before we wrap, one or two more questions. What do you think the implications of all this are going to be for the timing of approval of future drugs? If a drug is good enough, do we know enough to get it to the finish line faster? Are the things we're learning going to get it there slower? Well, didn't get there before resmetirom, so slower is probably not an option. But do we know things that will get it there faster?
Sven Frank.
That's a difficult one.
Yeah, I have lots of questions that I don't have answers to. That's why I'm asking them.
To predict, I think for the not on the very short term, I think it will hopefully increase the investment in, but in terms of changing, I think we still need a lot to learn how to work with NITs, not just in the selection of patients in the diagnosis, but also monitoring of disease evolution and assessing treatment response. There's still a lot to learn, so we're still waiting a little bit for that, although the data are coming, so that's fascinating, and I think that will probably make a true change in how this is all evaluated and may accelerate the proof. As long as we are not having that, we still have to wait for the clinical outcome trials, and that's already a shift, I think, in the paradigm of clinical trial design over the last 2 years, so that is promising, but I think for approval, probably we will have to wait until until we have a better way of working with the NITs and get them also accepted by the regulatory.
Makes sense. Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour, so why don't we go to wrap up? I guess my closing question is, now that we have a drug approved in the U.S. and coming to market in Europe, how will that affect any of the issues around the conduct of trials going forward as you see it in the context with the things that we've talked about in these two papers or any other context, really?
William Elazawi.
I mean, as somebody said at the start, you know, this is a game changer. This is a big, it's a milestone. And certainly in the U.S., people have already started prescribing medicine. There are people with MASH taking resmetirom. And I think there will be some questions. It'd be great to get some colleagues from the U.S. on to see, you know, just how widespread it is. Is everybody accessing it easily? You know, what's actually happening on the ground? You know, there will be a group of people who have the medicine who will want to think twice before being on a placebo-controlled trial. There will be many people who still don't have access to that medicine despite the licensing. And I think that they're going to be a population who, for whom clinical trials remain an attractive option. I can't see licensing in UK and Europe. It's not going to be immediate. There is a route with through the MHRA where stuff that's happened in the US can be brought across in a more rapid way. But for Europe itself, we've got two colleagues who can speak to that. Maybe that's going to be less of an issue. The next step will be reimbursement. So I think there is a bit of a road to travel before people are going to be on these medicines in Europe and in the UK. So it's business as usual for the time being. And at the moment, for a patient with NASH, MASH, who is at risk of progression, taking part in the clinical trial remains a trial option. And so in terms of the trials ongoing, I don't see that being a major problem yet.
Yeah, and what I also would hope and expect is that the narrative about screening and case finding will now rapidly change, because one of the arguments has always been, we can screen, but you don't have a treatment, which, by the way, in my opinion, was not right, but still it was in the mind of many people. I think that is also something that will rapidly change, and we will hopefully see much more screening and case finding in populations at risk, and more colleagues that are convinced that this is something that is worthwhile looking for. And that will help also the field forward.
That's a very important point. I remember a quote of Harrison on this podcast talking about shiny brochures are being brought to the physician's office. And I think that Sven just voiced that impression that, you know, the perception among fellow physicians, the referral pathways we've been working on, they're going to be used more heavily because we'll get more attention.
To that point, I agree with Will absolutely wholeheartedly. In the context that it doesn't change much here in the context of the current trial recruitment or Australia. Australia don't have a lot of their non-invasives on Medicare, for example. They're not refunded, so they don't have a fibro scan in the same way. It's just not routinely available. So clinical trials are going to be the best way to be cared for and done. It was interesting. There was an article published, I think, for World Liver Day that was the use of non-invasive diagnostic tools and metabolic dysfunction associated steatohepatitis. A qualitative exploration and challenges of the barriers. Now, that was by Jeff Lazarus, Emmanuel Toxidi, and Miru, and a few others, Marzen. But it only looked at the barriers and the challenges from the physician's perspective. Now, I can assure you, if you were talking to any of the providers of NITs into these areas, we have a lot of barriers trying to be able to bring better ways and smarter ways of getting these non-invasive, whether or not it's Siemens delivering ELF tests and things like that. There are lots of barriers into the system to be able to help develop. And I think, to Sven's point, we have to sort out some of those barriers in the next couple of years while we get access to these medications. We need to be case finding better and smarter. We need to be bringing down the barriers, and we need to be looking at unique and different strategies to do that and updating our pathways. Because some of the fears that they brought out were lack of knowledge. Nobody uses the pathways in the same consistent way. So they were the usual perspectives from the physician and the clinician side. But what we need to do is also have that discussion with the providers of these tests, Perspectum for MRI, PDFF, things like that. How do we bring down those barriers from both sides to help the patient and help hepatology and liver care move forward when we get these medications? Because we can do this. We need to look at it from all sides. But yeah, trials in Europe, I think, will stay for the next foreseeable future. And as we try and bring these barriers down and get better care, really.
Okay, so I'm struck by somewhere that Sven started and Will finished up and how they go together. If we're going to be in a world where patient heterogeneity has been a little bit complicated and we need to understand more about the patients going into our trials, If you look at the U.S. at a point in time where patients with certain kinds of insurance have much easier access to Rezdiffra than others, that will actually skew the U.S. trial population, right? If the idea is everyone who can get it will get it, everyone who can't get it will go into trials, there'll be some certainly socioeconomic skew in who goes into trials at that point. So the patients won't be as heterogeneous, which is maybe a good thing, maybe not. But the ways in which they're more homogeneous will be interesting. If you see more Hispanics, you're likely to see more PNPLA3, for example, or some of the genetic and microbiome predispositions. Certain disease concomitancies. And we're going to have to figure out how to take advantage of that, because obviously those aren't the only populations for which those drugs will work, but they may be the easiest ones in which to trial until at least you get a standard of care that isn't placebo.
And now, back to Roger.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. If you have any questions or comments about the content of this conversation or the entire episode, please put them in the review section of the page from which you downloaded this conversation, or send an email to questions at surfingmash.com. Next week, we will preview Global Fatty Liver Day from the Global Liver Institute, which will fall on June 13th. We'll have several patient advocates and at least one physician champion with us. Until then, stay safe, surf on, say a prayer for our departed colleague Stephen and his family, and we'll see you next week on the podcast. Bye-bye now.